But before I get to the subject of poverty and privacy, I'd like to put it in a context of the importance of the whole issue of privacy in this society. As Kenneth Boulding has put it in a very telling metaphor, the development of population in the world, the strain on our resources, is now such that we must consider ourselves as riding spaceship Earth, that we are going to have to recycle more and more processes, that we are going to have to organize life much more carefully if it's to sustain this many people. And if that is the case, then this process of survival is going to menace the privacy of us all. And in that sense, I think that the question of privacy, one's ability to be free from bureaucratic and rational organization, that question is one of the most basic questions of these times. This morning, I'd like to look at it particularly from the point of view of the poor, and first of all, to talk about poverty and privacy as a system of legal discrimination against the privacy of the poor. Secondly, to talk about the extra-legal discrimination against the privacy of the poor, which is, I think, even greater than the legal. And finally, to draw some conclusions about the nature of the law in relation to poverty and privacy from my analysis. So first of all, poverty is a system of legal discrimination against privacy on the part of governments. Most people in the labor market earn their incomes from jobs. They do not have their privacy in general invaded when they work. They work and they are paid. There are, however, a growing number of exceptions even there to the experience of most people. There are more and more invasions of privacy in the area of work for everyone. There are, for example, blacklists, which developed in the 1950s in all kinds of government jobs, in government-related jobs, such as working on docks or being a seaman, and which developed even in the movie and entertainment industry, where one's past political record would be checked out by some faceless person who would then submit your record to a producer, and you would be fired from a television show because of having signed a petition or participated in a march or something like that some years before. Recently, the House Internal Security Committee, the successor to the House Un-American Activities Committee, has published a new list of supposedly radical speakers who have spoken on college campuses, and they not only published their names but how much they received, as I suspect, a not too gentle hint to college administrations not to take such people who have such records as speakers in the future. In the area of non-poor invasion of privacy, you even have, in terms of the enormous growth of credit as an institution, a huge private bureaucracy which is checking on you. I discovered this in a crazy way, if I can be anecdotal for a minute, several years ago, when due to a small misunderstanding between me and American Express, my credit card was canceled, and I was renting a car, and I didn't have a credit card, so I called up, it was a station wagon, and I said, how can I rent this station wagon? I don't have a credit card. What kind of a deposit can I give you? And they said, we don't rent station wagons to people who only have money. You must have credit. And therefore, the fact that my credit privilege had been taken away from me for a while meant that I couldn't get an automobile. As it turned out, if I can finish the anecdote, I got it in a crazy way. I said to this young lady at Avis, well, look, can't you check it out somehow? And she said, yes, we can run a quick credit check on you. And I said, fine, what does that mean? She said, well, whom do you work for? I said, no one. And she said, oh, well, it's rather difficult to run a quick credit check. And then Avis does try harder. I said, well, look, I'm a writer. And it was right after Toward a Democratic Left came out. I said, I've just had a book published, and my picture is on the back of the book. Wouldn't that show that I'm a man of substance in the community? And she said, yes. And so I brought Toward a Democratic Left up to the Avis office and gave it to him. That was my quick credit check, and I got the automobile. But my point is that in terms of credit for everyone, not for the poor who don't have credit, in terms of credit in this society, you have a huge bureaucracy looking over you. But for the poor, there is now a special relationship to privacy. And that relation is that so many poor people get their incomes from welfare. And as a price of getting their incomes from welfare, they must make an enormous surrender of their right to privacy. They have to pay for it. Now, in saying this and in analyzing this, let me make one thing very clear at the outset, and that is, not all poor people are on welfare. Most poor people, as a matter of fact, are not. We are talking, when we talk about the problem of poverty, privacy, and welfare, we are talking about roughly a third of the poor, because two-thirds of the poor don't get any welfare. And indeed, as you'll see in a moment, I will suggest to you that this invasion of privacy that accompanies welfare is precisely designed in order to keep people off of welfare, to hound the people who are on welfare, and to keep other people off of welfare because they are unwilling to surrender the privacy that one must if you're going to get that kind of payment from the state, the city, or what have you. One of the excuses for this, the people on welfare have to surrender privacy. One of the excuses is the good old American assumption that people on welfare are a bunch of lazy cheats. Therefore, you have to check out every one of their statements. Therefore, you have to investigate them carefully. But recently, in a series of pilot programs, we've been making a very interesting experiment. We have taken the poor on their word. And when people have applied for welfare, rather than meticulously checking all of their statements about what their assets are, rather than doing that, we simply say, what do you have? What's your situation? You tell us, you write it down, and we will take you on your word. And we have then, in these experiments, spot-checked a tiny percentage just to see what kind of cheating was going on. And we have discovered through those experiments that poor people do cheat somewhat, not very much, and indeed that the misstatements on their declarations as a percentage are less than those of upper income people when they file their income tax. This is a society in which all kinds of middle class people can get absolutely and totally outraged about the way the poor are cheating welfare. And yet when those same people come to draw up their federal income tax, it becomes a work of high art and imagination. So we have now decided, on pragmatic grounds, in the federal government, has now decided to stop this invasion of privacy because it is so clearly unnecessary. And so if you read the St. Louis Post-Dispatch Sunday, you would have found there an article reporting how the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare is now going to require welfare departments all over the country to adopt that procedure of trusting the poor and not checking out every statement in deciding who is qualified for welfare. A second example of the invasion of privacy, aside from the fact that you have to be checked, is that in a good many situations, in order to qualify for welfare, you may have to give up the possibility of future income. If you have any possible asset, you have to deed it over to the state. If you have some lawsuit going that might in the future bring you some money, and you're, let's say, 68 years of age and in desperate straits, as a price for getting that help now, in some situations, you are required to give up the possibility of getting that money in the future. You have to show yourself to be totally and completely destitute in some of these situations. Thirdly, there is an invasion of privacy that I've mentioned several times around campus, in which anybody can observe in Champaign, Urbana, in any supermarket. The fact that when somebody who receives food stamps goes into the checkout line at the supermarket, there is a sign saying you must declare yourself. So to speak, you have to stand there and raise your hand and say, I am poor, because I get food stamps. And secondly, that sign also tells you that there are certain foods you cannot buy with food stamps, that your right to use the food stamps is circumscribed. But perhaps the most radical invasion of privacy of all is the famous man in the house rule, which, again, I've mentioned many times around here. The rule whereby a mother could not receive aid for dependent children if there is a man in the house. In a good many states, that is true even if the man is the woman's husband, because these states do not participate in the program Aid for the Dependent Children of the Unemployed, and it is a requirement, therefore, that the husband leave the house to feed his kids. And as a consequence of that, an enormous invasion of privacy. There is a clear correlation between unemployment and the breakup of marriages in areas like Appalachia, because the state will not tolerate a man in the house. Now, that rule has been thrown out in a good many situations by the courts. We're beginning to win the battle against the man in the house rule. And at this precise and exact moment in the Congress of the United States, the Dixiecrat senators are trying to put into the family assistance plan the man in the house rule. After the Supreme Court had declared in a very important case that aid for dependent children is aid to children, and that you cannot deprive a child of his food because of the presumed sins of his mother. After that, it seems to me a stunningly clear and persuasive argument. They're now trying to put man in the house back in. And as you know, what man in the house meant and means is that welfare investigators may try to make a quick attack on your house to jump in and see if somebody's there, to rush in and see if there are men's clothes in the closet, to see if there's evidence around the house that there has been a man there. And this becomes, in the terms of privacy, an extremely outrageous attempt to police the morals of the poor. The only people in this society who are required to be moral in order to get their money are poor people. The rest of us can be sinners. The poor we demand a higher standard of. Now, why is this? Why in the law have we set up so many provisions allowing privacy to be invaded by questionnaires, by surrendering of assets, by having to declare yourself in a food stamp line, by being subject to a raid by welfare officials to see if a man is around? Why? I would suggest, number one, because this is a very moralistic society which feels that the poor should be deserving before they should get any money. Lester Maddox put it most bluntly, of course, and was quoted by Fortune magazine in either the June or July issue. Maddox said, they should be made to feel like bums. And that's the point of view of a good many people in this society in our welfare program. A moral judgment against the poor. Secondly, and I suspect even more important than that moral attitude, is the fact that all of these invasions of privacy which hedge the right to welfare have the tendency to keep people off of welfare. That one of the main reasons why the majority of poor people don't get any money is because they don't know how to cope with this apparatus, and this apparatus is designed to discourage them, to make them dependent. Because you see, their welfare check is not a right. It's something that can be taken away. It's something that you have to go through all these procedures to get. That keeps people off the rolls very well. So it is, I'm convinced, that one of the main causes for the gigantic increase in welfare in a city like New York in recent times, where just yesterday the New York Times was reporting it had taken another stride upwards beyond expectation of the budget planners. One of the main reasons has been that organizations like the National Welfare Rights Organizations have allowed people for the first time to feel that this is a right of theirs to welfare, that they don't have to go hat in hand, that they don't have to subject themselves to these invasions of privacy, that they can fight back. And as a result of that, more people are taking advantage of rights they always had. Finally, I think that this invasion of privacy in the South is a means of controlling the labor market and controlling black people. That is to say, when you make welfare payments, so highly dependent upon conduct, when you have all of this discretion, all of this right to invade privacy, then you can keep people in their place. Number one, you can guarantee that there's going to be a supply of cheap, docile labor. And number two, you can remove somebody from welfare if he registers to vote. Thus, the paradox is that it is the South, if the Nixon Family Assistance Plan passes, it is the South which will gain the most. It is the white Southern poor who will gain even more than the black Southern poor, because there are more poor whites in the South than blacks. And yet, even though the South would gain the most in terms of income, even though every businessman in the South would make money out of the fact that a welfare family in Mississippi, which now gets $39 a month, which now gets about $500 a year, would get five times that. Even though that is the case, the Dixiecrats are against the family assistance plan, against something to provide money for their own constituents. To give you an idea of what's involved, if the family assistance plan went through, 35% of the people of Mississippi would receive some federal money. 25% in Louisiana, 22% in Georgia. And yet, the senators from Mississippi, Louisiana, and Georgia are fighting against the program which would provide those kinds of benefits for so many of their own people. Why? I'm suggesting they are fighting against it because they fear what it will do to the labor market. As Representative Landrum of Georgia so well put it, who is going to press my shirts if we have a family assistance plan like that? And the answer is no one. The answer is a woman would have to be crazy to iron and press Landrum shirts if she can get a minimum income on welfare that's more than he's willing to pay. And I think they are terrified of that, destroying their cheap labor supply, and they are terrified above all of the fact that black people would no longer be so dependent on the whim of the local authorities. There was an article this morning in the Wall Street Journal on precisely this point, and it had some marvelous quotations. I give you two from a Texas real estate investor talking in horrified tones about the consequences of passing the family assistance plan. And he says, those ethnic groups and Negroes, they don't want to say yes, sir. They want to sit down and have coffee with you. And he then says, you give all those people more money and you'll get more of them voting, which means there'll be more left-wingers running for office and winning because of the block vote. And God knows we've got enough left-wingers as it is. I think that's a very clear statement of why the racist South resists a plan which would reduce the invasion of privacy to the poor. Now, finally, in terms of this first point, to briefly indicate what we should do and then come back to it a little later on, it seems to me that we should, for openers, abandon absolutely all of the non-functional invasions of privacy now in the welfare system, which means practically all of them. That we should accept the word of the poor, that there should be no man in the house rule, that we should not give people food stamps but money to buy food, that in general, the ideal toward which we should work is that the poor should receive their income as of right. That's the principle. That it not be dependent on a bureaucracy, that it not be subject to conditions. So, first of all then, poverty and privacy is defined as a special area in which the law imposes special duties to surrender privacy upon individuals who are going to receive welfare. And I think that's scandalous. Secondly, what about the extra-legal invasion of the privacy of the poor? And this is really more important to my mind than the first point. Because if you would change all of those laws, if you would design the welfare system precisely as I want it to be defined, the poor would still have much less privacy than anyone else. And the fact of the matter is, the reason for that is, that the poor are jammed and concentrated together in larger numbers in miserable buildings to a degree that no one else is. And in a sense, you could almost say that the prime definition of urban poverty is that it has no privacy, that it is a condition of life in which your housing is such that you cannot really be private. We've discovered, for example, that this has a profound impact on the mental health of the poor, because, as I'm sure most of you know, it is not true, as so many people have thought, that it is the middle class and the upper middle class out there in suburbia dealing with the problems of alcohol and infidelity, which has the great problems of neurosis and psychosis, whereas the poor are sort of noble savages back there in the ghettos and out in the backwoods, who, it's true, they may be physically deprived, but they have that kind of animal vitality and et cetera. That is absolutely not true, because we have discovered in every study of the incidence of neurosis and psychosis that we have made in recent years, that the poor have qualitatively more neurosis and psychosis than any other social class in the society. And I would suggest to you that one of the reasons that psychologists have suggested to explain this fact is the lack of privacy. That is to say, in the Freudian model of the personality, which is basically a middle-class model, it is the mother figure, father figure, and sibling. They are the decisive personalities for the development of another human personality. But our research suggests, under conditions of poverty where everybody is jammed together, you become aware just of all these other people impinging on your life, where the noise level, the fact that arguments are heard, the fact that people are jammed together in small quarters, becomes something that wears away, that grinds down, that scars the personality of the poor. And therefore, I would suggest that the lack of simple physical privacy in a slum may well be a factor causing people to have nervous breakdowns, to have neurotic and psychotic traits. We also know, of course, from research about poverty, that this is true about sexuality. That one of the things that one of the deprivations of privacy in a poor family is that you so often have single families, entire families, living in a single room. Therefore, under conditions of poverty, it is absolutely commonplace for very small children to have a first-hand acquaintance with sex, being in the single room with a large family, and often a first-hand acquaintance with some of the more unfortunate aspects of sexuality. Therefore, I'm suggesting that this lack of privacy extends not simply to the mental health of the poor, but gets to deal with something as intimate and important in human existence as sexuality. Indeed, from my point of view, the extraordinary thing about the poor is the degree to which they are able to resist these pressures, the strength which they exhibit. That is to say, given all of the factors which are conspiring to make life so enormously difficult for a poor person, particularly giving these factors which rob that person of privacy in many aspects of his life, as student, as husband, as wife, robbing them of their privacy, the extraordinary thing to me is that poor people have found within themselves the strength to resist those pressures and to lead stable and, in some cases, productive and creative lives. What I am saying, then, is that it seems to me that the crucial issue with regard to poverty in general, and particularly with regard to privacy in poverty, is that we have got to solve the housing problem in America. That as long as we do not solve that basic problem, we are kidding ourselves that we care about poverty, privacy, or anything else. I saw an excellent example of what could be done some years ago in Washington, D.C., and it relates to this whole question of privacy and poverty. There were a couple of young men who had been involved in ADA in Washington, and somebody challenged them and said that that was much too much of a parlor exercise in progressivism. They should do something. So they went out and they bought a couple of buildings in a black slum in Washington. And they found other housing for 3/4 of the people in those buildings. In those houses, people had been living one family to a room. These guys moved out 3/4 of the family, finding them better quarters somewhere else. They then took the houses with the 1/4 of the families that continued to live there, and those families worked and fixed them up, so that now each family had a floor, where before each family had a room. Now each family had its own bathroom, where before the entire building used one bathroom. Now each family had its own kitchen, where before there was only one kitchen for the entire building. And it turned out, I saw these houses, they were extraordinarily good-looking houses, because they were the old Washington style of architecture, which in Georgetown now provides the homes of the rich. The reason why that black slum is not as beautiful as Georgetown is primarily because there are too many people in it. And the solution to that problem and many other problems, it seems to me, is to reduce that density that makes possible decent kind of housing. Now, in saying this, I don't want to get taken into a trap, which I think some people fall into, which is to assume that somehow absolute numbers are a social problem. I think our problem in this country is not so much with the number of people we have, but how we organize the conditions of their lives. There is a population problem. But what I am saying is that if we built new cities and new towns, if we really imaginatively tried to deal with that problem, it would be much less than it is. So, secondly then, repeal all of the anti-privacy laws to which the poor are subjected, and they would still have very little privacy. Because most of the poor live under conditions of such crowding and poor housing that they lead some of the most intimate aspects of their lives in semi-public. I am suggesting that this affects all kinds of aspects of the life of the poor. It affects their emotional life. It affects their sexual life. It affects the most intimate details of their family life. And I am saying that, given that fact, we cannot romanticize slums and ghettos. We cannot romanticize them. It is true that they have produced families of extraordinary strength, but life cannot be lived at its best under those conditions, and therefore it is, to my mind, the most fundamental priority in terms of privacy and in terms of the whole range of problems associated with poverty to create decent housing for everyone in the United States. Finally, let me try to generalize my analysis and relate it to the question of law and the way that one thinks about the law. There's an old tradition in this country, and not only in this country, to think of the law in negative terms, and particularly to think of privacy in negative terms. What is the responsibility of the law to the value of privacy? In this theory, its responsibility is to leave people alone, not to interfere with their lives, not to invade their lives. I think that kind of a theory in the Western philosophy goes all the way back to thinkers like Hobbes and Kant, who had an argument that each individual in the society is pursuing his own personal goals, and it is the function of the law simply to stop people from colliding with one another. In that image, society is basically unsocial. And what the law does is it sets up ground rules, and it can be called to attention for interfering too much in people's lives. I think that's a very valuable tradition. And I think in terms of it, as I'll get to in a minute, there are a whole series of policy choices that follow. But there is a second image of society, which is mine, which differs from that Hobbesian or Kantian idea of the unsocial society. And it is that there is a possibility in society for people not simply to avoid hurting one another, but for people to help one another, for people to come together. And that's a concept of law not as a negative thing, not as a restraint, but as a positive thing, as a creative force. And what I'm suggesting this morning is that in the area of privacy and poverty, we need to emphasize both of these interpretations of what the law is. First, negatively. It seems to me that we should have in the law, with regard to the poor, a presumption of privacy. That is to say, it is presumed that a poor person is like any other person in the society, and that the poor person should not be required to surrender any right in order to get assistance from the state where that is needed. That presumption can only be rebutted where it can be shown that some checking into the life of the poor person has a function which will really help that person's welfare. That those invasions of privacy which we now tolerate in the area of poverty can no longer be justified on the grounds that poor mothers should be more faithful than middle-class mothers, or that the poor men and women do not have the right to drink, and so forth and so on. We have to abandon that whole way of looking at the problem of welfare and presume privacy. And it seems to me that the lawyers among you should find some way in developing the law to bring such a presumption into the courts of the United States. Secondly, still on this negative side of things, but talking now about the passage of a law, it seems to me in this area, as well as in many other areas of American life, we clearly need a new weapon against bureaucracy. I suggested it some time ago. Let me put it forward again. What we need in this society is a National Bureaucratic Relations Act, like the National Labor Relations Act. That is to say, prior to the National Labor Relations Act, it was assumed in this society that the conflict between labor and management was a purely private conflict, which operated under the rules of contract and anything went. And we then came to an understanding in the 1930s, primarily an understanding forced upon the society by the struggle of an awful lot of working people. We came to an understanding that that no longer worked, and that we had to establish a context, a social context, in which this struggle between management and labor would take place. And we therefore said, the society asserts its superior right to establish the rules of the game. I'm suggesting now that for the poor, for students, for people who can't get credit and can't get automobiles to rent, for all kinds of people in this society, more and more there is the problem of bureaucracy. And therefore, what we need to do is to have a law establishing rights of the citizens vis-a-vis the bureaucrats. For example, one aspect of such a law, as I've imagined it, could be that every bureaucracy is required to establish an independent review board, something on the lines of the Independent Review Board of the United Automobile Workers, where a group of people independent of that bureaucracy can be appealed to by someone who is complaining against the bureaucracy. For example, if there is a charge of police brutality, that it not be investigated by the police, who, I would seem to me, it's rather obvious, have a certain self-interest in not finding too much police brutality. There be an independent review board. That there be an independent review board in all welfare institutions. So that if somebody is aggrieved, they can get a judgment on their grievance by someone outside of the system. Because the problem that the poor face in so many of these situations, with the police, with the school system, with the welfare system, is that when they complain, the associates of the people they complain against decide whether the complaint is good or bad. And therefore, if they are to have their privacy protected from bureaucratic intervention and invasion, it seems to me that they need that kind of a bureaucratic relations act, those kinds of independent review boards. And I might add, so do many of us as well, who are not poor. A third area where it seems to me that the law can be in its, this negative sense of removing constraints, a third area where I think the law has a great deal to do, and as a matter of fact, I learned much about this in some discussions in a class here at the law school, is in the whole area of zoning. That one of the reasons why poor people are jammed together the way they are is that so many of our cities have the famous white noose around the black central city. Zoning restrictions, which herd people in and jam them together and make it impossible for them to break out into the privacy of suburbia. And it seems to me that in addition to legislation, there is a possibility of using existing legal doctrines to challenge those zoning restrictions, and in that way to solve a good many problems, but one of them would be to provide access to privacy to poor people, because it is something which we now systematically deny them in so many of our activities. If I can turn now from that negative kind of procedure of getting people off the backs of the poor, of getting zoning restrictions off of the backs of the poor, of eliminating all of these non-functional invasions of privacy. If I can turn from there to the positive, that is to say the legislative, I think it's here that the issue is really going to be settled. I think it's here because it's clear to me, as I indicated before, that unless that housing issue is settled, there is not going to be any privacy for the poor, no matter what we do. And that is going to require planned investments of billions of dollars if we're going to deal with it. Moreover, it seems to me that we are going to have to plan the use of a lot of other things. Beaches, for example. You now have around a big city like New York, every community which has ocean beaches is beginning to put up restrictions on those beaches because they don't want the city folks coming out and making the beaches less private. And I don't think that the motivation is consciously racist, although it is true that by making these restrictions, as with all of the zoning restrictions, by making these restrictions, you are particularly striking out against the right of blacks, of Puerto Ricans, and other minorities to go to those beaches. But those kinds of scarce goods, private beaches, we now have to plan. It seems to me what I am saying, in terms of poverty, but in terms of the society as a whole, that paradoxically, if we are going to have more privacy under our present conditions, we have to have more public plan. I say paradoxically because it would seem that to plan publicly is to take more things into the out of the area of privacy and into the area of public decision, yet I think that's the only way to deal with these things. And this means to me, finally, that in terms of the most important things and trying to deal with the problem of privacy and poverty, you have to have a political struggle. A legal struggle is not enough. And I cite as my demonstration of this fact the recent events with regard to the man in the house rule. The Supreme Court of the United States strikes down a man in the house rule. The Supreme Court of the United States says quite rightly the Social Security Act provided that those monies for children, not for mothers, and you cannot take the money away from the kids on the basis of what their mothers did. And we begin to move finally towards a rational policy in this area and to do away with these outrageous invasions of privacy. And no sooner is that done than the reactionaries in Congress are counterattacking on the family assistance plan and trying to make their price of approving a minimum income for poor people in the United States the reintroduction of the man in the house rule. Because you see, then, even though those black people in Georgia would have an income that wouldn't require them to press Representative Landrum's shirt, then you could always go in the middle of the night and get enough people off of welfare in order to get enough people to press the shirts for the society. And therefore, you have to defeat that politically. So if I can summarize then, I suggest to you, first of all, that in terms of special laws, the poor legally have less privacy than any of us, particularly those on welfare, who are required in ways which are not functional to surrender a good deal of their privacy to investigators and to policemen of their morality. Secondly, I am suggesting that even if, however, We abolished all of those discriminatory laws. We stopped all of those invasions of privacy. The economic and social conditions under which most of the poor live are very unprivate. And that this kind of dense concentration of people has affected mental health, it's affected sexuality, it's affected family life, and just about everything else. And I'm saying, thirdly, by way of proposing how to deal with it, that we should deal with it in a negative sense of removing all of the non-functional interferences with privacy that now exist. That's, to my mind, almost all of them. And in a positive sense, by creating the environment, the conditions, the possibility for privacy for poor people, which means to get them out of the concentration camps, the urban concentration camps in which we have locked them by so many of our economic and social and legal policies, and get them out where they too can have space and air and privacy. And I'm saying that this has to be done politically. And if I could make a summary point on this and on the whole subject of poverty, here, as in the area of poverty in general, I am really not saying that we should treat the poor better than anyone else. All I am saying, and yet ironically it is a very radical thing to say, is that we should treat the poor as well as everyone else. That we should treat the poor in terms of the money we spend on them as well as we treat the suburban home builder who gets much more. And that we should treat the poor in terms of privacy, as people not having a special right to privacy, but as people who do have a moral and political and legal and social right to as much privacy as anybody else in this society. Thank you.